So yeah, Marsha McLuhan's Mosaic, Probing the Literary Origins of Media Studies. So there's Elena Lamberti. She's Italian, and she wrote this book. She kind of explains that she did it because her one student came in and said, well, what's the minimum I have to do in this course? What are the fewest pages I have to read of this particular novel in order to get a passing grade? So she realized that she was losing students just to them wanting to get marks instead of wanting to learn literature. So when Bob read this book, he suggested I read it, and I think right away I liked it, and I'm liking it more and more as I go along. And it's getting repetitive, and what the repetitiveness is describing how McLuhan, with his literary background and his literary criticism background, he took literature, took the modernist authors like Joyce and Eliot and Pound and Lewis, and he built on that. He took East and West together. He took literature and theater and music and science and wove it all into what she calls a mosaic. Now, it was interesting tonight to hear about Thiel talking about the mosaic. And when Bob gets his book and sits down, that's one of the first questions is, do you think Lamberti got the word mosaic, which is the title, Marsha McLuhan's Mosaic? Did she get that from Thiel, or is it that a word that McLuhan had been using throughout? So we've gotten up to page 32, and I'm up to about page 105, and there is kind of an interweaving and a repetition of what Lamberti's writing, but what Bob and I do is just I gave a quote that I'm interested in. I try to get Bob to listen to me talking about what I think the quote evoked for me, but usually Bob just launches into what the quote is really saying, and then Bob will sort of expand, go off into half a dozen different sidebars about the quote and what he's getting from it. And pretty often he'll kind of bring up what Lamberti is going to talk about. Bob's read the whole book already, so I don't know if he memorized it yet, but he's read the book. So, Bob, that's my overview. You had enough time, unless are you eating now or something? Well, yeah, Bob says, I think it was in the tailgate after the Tuesday What Youth Show. Alyssa from Vietnam, she was saying, well, yeah, Bob, you should let Carolyn talk more. So, yeah, I'm talking more and giving the overview, but we have to start reading the quotes. And you don't want me to read the quotes until you have your book in hand. Oh, Bob said I can read the quotes. So on page 32, the section that we're going into is called Postliterate Paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A, and that is in ancient Greek. It means education or upbringing, the culture of a society. So it's a description of what Lambert is talking about, the culture of their society, but it's the post-literate culture. So the first quote is, McLuhan uses his mosaic to question traditional ideas of knowledge. Now, she has mosaic in italics, knowledge in italics, and to move the reader from a linear, in italics, bracket, logical, ordered, exclusive, bracket, to an acoustic, in italics, bracket, non-logical, simultaneous, inclusive. So let me read that without the sidebars. McLuhan uses his mosaic to question traditional ideas of knowledge to move the reader from a linear, logical, ordered, exclusive to an acoustic, non-logical, simultaneous, inclusive, next page, perspective. So that's pretty much what we've been quoting all along, that McLuhan is bringing, and what I said at the outset, he's bringing together, creating a mosaic with the linear and acoustic and a printing press and the radio, and creating his mosaic. Next quote. He experimented with interdisciplinary, before interdisciplinary studies were the fashion, and even worse, he appeared to enjoy it. So that's a quote from someone, but I've obscured it with my highlighting. That we talked about already tonight with Thiel. Thiel took the interdisciplinary model from McLuhan and did it in his studies, as McLuhan did the Coach House, you know, his Monday night sessions. Everybody came together. And the next quote, by surpassing writing, we have regained our wholeness. Now, wholeness is in capital letters. So by surpassing writing, we have regained our wholeness, not on a national or cultural, but cosmic plane. Now, I definitely wanted Bob to come in here. And she continues, not on a national or cultural, but cosmic plane. He wrote as early as 1954. So let me see if I can find the footnote there. No, it won't come up for me. But in 1954, maybe Bob can tell us what book McLuhan wrote that in, to be talking about the cosmic plane and what he thinks McLuhan meant by that. So she says, being a grammarian, McLuhan's vocation was to explore such wholeness, looking for connections through differences acting on a cosmic plane. So, yeah, we want to go into that. And then she says, McLuhan insisted that in the information age, the specialist is an anachronism, someone who, according to him, never makes small mistakes while moving toward the grand fallacy. So this is his McLuhan's antagonism to specialists, and I don't know if he calls himself a generalist or he just says he's not a specialist and wants to be inclusive. He reconsidered the idea of education and refused the compartmentalized academic method of investigation, since they no longer mirrored the new reality. So, I mean, that's basic stuff that we've been quoting all along. A few more pages along, Lamberti says, humor played a central role in the elaboration of McLuhan's poetics. Verbal and conceptual playfulness pervades all his books and interviews, contributing to the accusation that he lacks scholarly integrity, rigor, and method. And that was just, you know, a way of trying to put down someone who people just didn't understand. So I come up to the next heading, but Bob's putting himself in position, and hopefully he won't do too much diversion. Basically, Bob, tell us about this cosmic quote.
Well, your first quote, I want to explain. You asked me about the term mosaic.
Of course, yes. We're going to rehash everything, right?
Yeah. So mosaic is a key term that you learn in McLuhan.
But did Thiel bring it to Lamberti, or McLuhan talked about it?
McLuhan talked about it.
Okay.
In Gutenberg Galaxy, he introduces the book saying this book is different. It's presenting a mosaic of evidence from different fields, it's not a linear process or laying out one argument, one point. He's not taking you to one point. He wants you to see, to quote Joseph Conrad, the novelist, he wants you to see something that's not limited to the eyes.
Yeah.
And his term for that is mosaic. And so anybody who reads McLuhan reasonably, at least takes a bit of it in, they may not understand it all, knows the term mosaic, and they all fall on it.
Okay, good.
So for me, say Marshall McLuhan's mosaic is like the most cliche McLuhan term you can have in your title. You know, it's the most normal thing.
No, but it's what he wrote, and it's just an explanatory title.
Yeah, and she then does a good job of explaining the components of the mosaic.
Right.
So that was on page 32?
Yeah. But we're going on to the cosmic one next.
Okay. So that's in 1954. That's in Counterblast.
Okay.
And I'll just check that. That would be the first chapter. After the introduction, there's prologue, a renewed approach to Marshall McLuhan's poetics. What's the footnote for it? What number?
I don't know, Bob.
Well, what page is on?
32, Post-Literate Paideia is the heading.
Oh, yeah. And the Paideia is a term associated with Ezra Pound. I think there's a critical journal or newsletter or something about Pound called Paideia.
Yeah, it sounds vaguely familiar.
Right. So
I have a footnote. It looks like 56 around the mosaic.
Yeah, 56, 57. Counterblast, 1954, right. So it is Counterblast. And Counterblast, 1954, is redone in 1969 with a lot of stuff added to it. But McLuhan, it almost presents his reality in poetic form. It's a lot of one-liners and aphorisms or just a couple of sentences and then a space and then another interesting thought.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, direct prose like Mechanical Bride or later Gutenberg Galaxy. So Don Thiel brought this up. See, we know cosmic from cosmic consciousness, cosmic awareness, cosmic, R. Crumb talks about cosmic. It is a counterculture term or phrase of awesomeness or wow, it's cosmic.
Mm-hmm.
And another woman who did a book on McLuhan, Janine Marchessault, her book is called Cosmic Media.
Wow.
So only women talk about the cosmic stuff other than me and Dawn. So I had never brought up cosmic to anybody, but I noticed, okay, he's saying cosmic plane, that's a little Gnostic or mystical or Aquarian, you know, for a guy like McLuhan to use that term. And one day I was talking to Don, and we might have got into cosmic topics, and he says, yes, and you know, McLuhan actually uses the term cosmic. Don pointed it out as it's very significant or odd that McLuhan would take such a term, but technically it comes from Richard Books, a Canadian psychologist who, you know, around 1900 did a book on cosmic consciousness, and he was inspired by his friendship with Walt Whitman, and Whitman's talking about mystical stuff. So it's about, you know, a eureka phenomenon done by a psychologist, but it's called cosmic consciousness. And I don't know if there's many books with that kind of title way back in, you know, 120 years ago.
Right.
So Don knew of the oddness of it in McLuhan land, and I noticed it. So we both interpreted it as McLuhan is aware of – that's his nod to esoteric Rosicrucian Freemasonry terminologies, vocabulary.
Yeah, it's like a gotcha. He's saying, I know you're out there.
Well, yeah, he's saying – he once wrote that that the incarnation of Christ changed matter. the matter was forever changed by Christ. When we used to talk to the medium, Dave Worster, and he channeled cosmic awareness, he talked about the change in matter happening in the 60s when Rai, the original separateness, returned to the plane of essence. But McLuhan projected that, and I think cosmic awareness said something about Christ changing matter. So McLuhan had the term. I thought it was interesting. He had that idea that Christ changed matter. And I guess you tap into it. It's timeless. You become a devout Christian or something, you can tap into the new matter that Christ created. So, and that relates to our work with Ion, which is amazing. So, so he said that about Jesus, and then he talked about changing on a cosmic plane. That can be a Christian thing, that media are catching up to what Jesus Christ did. They're changing matter.
Yeah, so she's saying, but your passing and writing, we have regained our wholeness, not on a national or cultural, but cosmic plane. And she quotes, what did you say?
The Counterblast.
Counterblast. And he wrote that in 1954. Okay.
Yeah, see, and this, now this is what interests me, McLuhan, because in the late 60s, as I learned the metaphysics of cosmic awareness, they were talking about the return to wholeness because the original separateness got absorbed back into the plane of essence. And here's McLuhan saying the same thing back in 54. We have regained our wholeness. So what's the we? Not on national cultural, but on matter level, on the being level of humanity. So that's a very amazing mystical statement.
And it's by surpassing writing. So it's more than just the word, because the word is supposed to be pretty important.
Well, the word can be the flower of evil. That could be the beginning of separateness. But McLuhan is not going to knock words in that sense. So it's just writing. And he does say way back in the 40s and 50s, he regarded the Industrial Revolution as original sin, and the printing press is like the fall of man. He talks about that in the Playboy interview in 69, but he says that he doesn't judge things like that anymore. But it is part of his deeper Gnostic part of himself and he's agreeing with Ion that the printing press brought in the Dark Ages.
Right.
And the printing press says the previous era is the Dark Ages. Right? The medieval period is the Dark Ages, and history, printed history says that's when the Dark Ages are. But they're covering up the fact, the book is covering up the fact that it's brought in a Dark Age for 300 years till 1900.
And we have to surpass that.
Well, we're being forced to adapt to a surpassal that's happened.
Yes. Yes. Okay, moving on?
Yep.
Okay, now, I mentioned the specialist versus, does he call them generalists, or what does he, what's the counterpoint to specialist?
Yeah, generalist. And I read the quote from Thiel talking about McLuhan, somewhere's in there, he says, McLuhan was a specialist in communications. And that's not accurate, but from academia point of view, yeah, he specialized in mass media. So Eric, in an interview when the center was closing in 1980, the Toronto Star, I think, did an interview with him, and he said he was a specialist in generalisms.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, right. Specialist in generalisms, so it can be a specialist. But you're asking, what does McLuhan mean by specialism?
Or? No, no, what's his counter to it? Did he use the word generalist?
No, he usually said he was a comprehensivist. He was like
that's right.
Bucky Fuller's awareness or integral awareness.
Yeah.
Integral awareness, comprehensive awareness. I think Barry Nevitt brought in the comprehensive term for Take Today. But they had met Bucky Fuller, and McLuhan had corresponded with Bucky Fuller since 1961. They had a special symposium for corporations in the Bahamas in January 1970. There's a picture of Barry and Marshall and Bucky Fuller on the beach together. So Bucky was at that place. So Barry Nevitt probably got into Bucky Fuller, if not before, as a result of that meeting. And so integral awareness, comprehensive. He would say he doesn't have a point of view.
Yeah.
A specialist has a point of view, is building data to lead to a major point. And what's that quote? Paying very special attention, McLuhan said, the specialist gets all the details on the way.
Never makes small mistakes while moving toward the grand fallacy.
Yeah. So when McLuhan says to Woody Allen, you think my whole fallacy is wrong, that would be calling McLuhan a specialist. He specialized in media. If a fallacy is just applied to literate sensibilities, okay. Under electric conditions, it becomes a fallacy.
Okay, good. We're moving on now. The next one I mentioned was his humor. So that we know.
I just want to show on page 32, you have post-literate paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A. Then the next section is called From Integral Awareness to Storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's interesting that Lamberti thinks that everything in the end comes down to telling a story. And that's like life in the end is linear and narrative. But it can be said differently in different conditions, different media styles. But why is she going from integral awareness to storytelling? Well, if you're putting on the book, if you're going to write a book and put on that visual bias, you're going from integral awareness to a specialist medium. So storytelling can be a specialist activity, maybe, is how she means it here.
Yeah, but storytelling itself is very general, very all-encompassing.
No, but it has the beginning, middle, and end. It has a conclusion. Integral awareness deals with a society and environment that doesn't have a beginning or end.
So she should be saying from storytelling to integral awareness.
No.
If we're trying to move toward comprehensive.
Yeah, but she's writing a book. And so she's going to explain McLuhan by book, by telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
So she's admitting she's putting on the literate bias.
Okay.
We'll give her that possibility. I don't know if she's aware of that. Maybe she is. I don't know how conscious she is of that, of her put on. But we can assume it's very conscious.
Right.
So where are we? What page?
Right exactly there. That's the next section where I had some clips. And the integral awareness to storytelling. And it's, look up where this quote, when Sputnik went around the planet, nature disappeared. Nature was hijacked right off the planet. Nature was enclosed in a man-made environment, and art took the place of nature. Planet became art form. So you talk about this a lot, you know. Is this like the four parts, obsolesced, retrieved? Is that what he's talking about there? Or is this just a detachment of one media obsolescing the previous media?
Yeah, so the Sputnik, the spaceship, is an extension not of our bodies, inner or outer faculties. It's an extension of the planet, the natural habitat organism itself. And he got that. He clarified that after reading Bucky Fuller, who talked about the man-made environment. The satellite's a completely terrestrial situation made by humans that you can live in. It's an artificial environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a simulation of our terrestrial world that we live and breathe in. So they made a tin can that you could live and breathe in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an extension of the planet, nature, whatever you want to call it. Nature is a doubtful term because that's a product of visual space, calling something nature. So just call it a planet. So the Sputnik went around the planet, obsolesced the planet, which means if it's obsolesced, everybody becomes aware of it and gets involved in it, and that created ecology. The ecology factor, the word ecology is not said here, but that's what he means when he says art took the place of nature. The whole content of the planet, the media and the humans and that, were orchestrated and programmed like it was an artwork with the effects of what you're doing in mind. So art took the place of nature, nature being an unpredictable, uncontrolled environment. So when Sputnik went around the planet, nature disappeared. Now, that would be the literate category of nature, because media are nature, according to McLuhan. So the media are the new environments as content of the satellite.
Uh-huh.
So literate nature disappeared. Literate nature was hijacked right off the planet. Nature was enclosed in a man-made environment. That man-made environment is the new nature.
The new media.
Yeah.
Or the media. Yeah.
Yeah, because the media are nature. That's his main percept.
Right.
And so virtual reality is real, what McLuhan's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So then programming the whole content, all these older media environments that are the content of the spaceship Sputnik environment, they are the new art. So that...
And where's this quote from?
Page 62, it's from a video. She has here, McLuhan, Florida State University lecture, 1970, in video McLuhan 5, written and narrated by Tom Wolfe. That's the raw footage that Stephanie McLuhan used to make her hour-long McLuhan documentary, or maybe it's an hour and a half long,
mm-hmm.
that was played everywhere, PBS and that, in 84.
Mm.
And Zappa saw it and told me, he said, it looked like McLuhan was not all there. He thought McLuhan was, like, a bit damaged in the head. But anyways, I bought the videos back. Okay, so she in 84 she makes this documentary, and it gets a lot of attention. It's well done. And then a few years later, she goes around to all the networks that she got the footage from, or she already had the footage, but she got permission to sell the whole section, which she just excerpted in the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
So you buy 6 or 7 video cassettes, which I did, and you have all these interviews. Well, the one I know of, the one in Florida is in 1974, unless there's a second one, but... Mainly, in my mind, and I have a good memory for these details, Florida State University lecture, it should be 1974, and it's in the fifth McLuhan collection of complete footage.
Yeah, I noticed in her references she doesn't put dates.
That's interesting. Yeah, she doesn't, does she?
No.
Doesn't tell when the books were made.
No,
sometimes there are. Maybe when she first quotes the book, there's a date. Yeah, there's dates.
Uh-huh.
But when they're repeated, that she doesn't repeat the date. No, there's dates, but not everywhere.
Okay, so...
Okay, so this is in the 70s, and he is talking about the planet. He says, planet became art form. That's discussed in Counterblast in 69, probably in 68. I'm not sure if it's in media, the medium is the massage. It might be. Might even be in an understanding media, but it's an old idea. Mm-hmm. By the time he's saying it in Florida, it's when we watched the premiere of the McLuhan's Wake around 2004-2005 in New York City,
mm-hmm.
David Sobelman and crew came, and they had, since Laurie Anderson, the pop singer, abstract artist kind of person, married Lou Reed.
Mm-hmm.
She was a narrator in it, I think. Yeah, a narrator. And so she came to watch it, and there was a panel after. And on the panel, she said, that idea that the planet, you know, becomes an art form when the satellite goes around it, what a beautiful idea. She was totally floored by it. And I guess she'd never heard it before. Maybe she didn't say it in whatever part she did in the voiceover. But she generally was impressed with that. So what that means is that the Gutenberg arts, painting, music, sculpture, ballet, theater, all those arts are no longer art. They're no longer serving as anti-environments,
mm-hmm.
the serious arts. So what becomes the anti-environments is the media, the electric media, movies, TV, and radio. But they do not serve as anti-environment effectively. So McLuhan says, maybe on page 31 of Counterblast 1969 version, that a rapid series of innovations is an anti-environment. And then you reread it. Oh, he put the word ersatz in front of anti-environment. It's a fake anti-environment. You cannot make an anti-environment of the global theater, which means everybody gets, like magnets, just joined with the environment, you know, sucked into and stuck to it.
Mm.
And that's why McLuhan says the only way you can really create an anti-environment to a new medium is turn off the new medium. The only thing you can do is turn it off. So McLuhan said his strategy of turning off the media in a balanced way, orchestrating an on and off, that was the only role of anti-environment, and he was aware of it, and he announced it, so he was the only anti-environment to what was happening. Everybody else was a victim of the magnetizing of us, and it's like the image of a cartoonist, a cartoon of a guy watching TV, but his head has gone through the screen. And McLuhan talked about the viewer becomes the screen. There's Krishnamurti, or the Buddhist idea that the observer merges with the observed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that happened technologically with television.
Right.
So we're all melted and merged, and a rapid series of innovations in any of the old analog electric media is the closest you come up to a simulation, an attempt at an anti-environment.
Okay.
So that's why art.
Get off track there.
That's why.
Move on.
No. I'm explaining the thing. And that's
what
why.
Thing?
That quote, the last sentence, planet became an art form. Okay? And art took the place. So all the traditional arts become victims of cowboys. Billionaires, millionaires come running in and hijack the whole Gutenberg Galaxy Arts, and especially painting, and start selling your mother's painting for $5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the commodification of art, and yet they don't make that clear to students in art classes, and they go around, Reiner has to deal with this, they go around trying to fit into the art world, and they've been given a hoax.
Why? Because, well, everything's art. If the planet becomes art form, everything's art, so everything goes. Andy Warhol could sell tin cans.
Yes,
you
but
mean it in that way?
No, because they have the quote, art is anything you can get away with in mediums of massage.
Mm-hmm.
But people think McLuhan said it. I don't think he said that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a quote from the art world. And McLuhan says you can tell which things are going to be the art form of their day through figure ground analysis. So why does Andy Warhol have the right to call himself the Pope of American art? Because he took the most recent environment, the software media world of movies and magazines, and put them as the content of his silk screens, and showed a previous mega art form. Movies are now the content in the satellite, and that's the closest to gallery art you can make, old-fashioned Gutenberg art. So he is more relevant than conceptual art or op art or all the other arts that burst up in the 60s with him. His is technically accurate because McLuhan's rule is the previous environment becomes an art form. So movies and magazines and that kind of Hollywood culture became the content of the gallery through Andy Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
So you rest your case.
I wonder what Reiner would say about this. Should we bring him in?
Yeah.
And let me just see if Reiner's still there and see what the art professor says. I got to reconnect it. No, Reiner's gone. Well, Reiner, if you're still listening, drop in and make a commentary. Okay, maybe he'll call back in if he's still listening. So you want to move on to the next quote. But
yeah.
It's just really important so the art students are not told why suddenly a colleague of theirs in the graduate school suddenly becomes a millionaire.
I know, and we've talked about that many times.
Yeah.
That's a common theme around Dobbstown.
Okay.
Okay, the next clip McLuhan insisted that at play, man uses all his faculties. At work, he specializes. So that's, again, a standard McLuhanism.
Now, where is that?
Just below, right in the next paragraph, below Sputnik.
Okay. In fact, while speaking as a scholar, McLuhan nevertheless behaved as an artist in italics, challenging the given rules. Now, McLuhan had the right to say he was the only artist around because he was way beyond the art field, the art, the Gutenberg limited world of Clement Greenberg and these guys. I mean, he's actually telling you what art as in any environment does, a teaching machine. Media were the teaching machines for people, and electric media in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And McLuhan said, quote, "The artist cannot be the prudent and decorous Ulysses, but appears as a sham. As sham and mime, he undertakes not the ethical quest," see, you can't have ethics in the electric environment, "but the quest of the great fool. He must become all things in order to reveal all, and to be all things, he must empty himself." Is that what you read?
The next, I didn't read that. I read the very next sentence.
This aphorism? Or
consistently, he insisted that a playman uses...
That's not the next sentence.
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Consistently, he insisted that, quote, "at play, man uses all his faculties. At work, he specializes." What do you think that means?
It's just an example of how he defines a specialist and a comprehensivist. He's reminding people that... they tend to specialize too much at work.
Well, why is an artist or somebody using all his faculties not a specialist?
Because they're using all their faculties. They're not just specializing in one thing.
Well, a better way might be, you include that, but he doesn't have a goal.
Mm-hmm.
A specialist has a goal. They have to get the work done.
They have to make money.
Yeah, now you could say there's a goal within the painting game to make a certain art form with a certain effect, but it's...
Yeah, and maybe that's what happened when the plan became art form. It did become too commercial. It became commodified.
Well, it became the content of a capitalist print-based money economy. So
right.
It didn't become commodified. You know, when that actually happened with the printing press, McLuhan says that nature and humans became robotic contents, consumed content of the printing press.
Mm.
See, so by the time you get the 60s, humans and nature are gone. What is the content is the previous media environments in an informational constant process. So most people are acting out the end time scenario of 500 years ago. Of the destruction of humans by the printing press. Right? And they don't see that the Android meme is surfacing and becoming its own Armageddon for itself. So that's the science fiction level that McLuhan's on there.
Right.
But that's pretty neat, eh? All the biblical stuff, all the end time stuff, all this worrying about the planet being polluted. Well, it is part of the content of the information processor consuming everything, commodifying everything. But it's even worse. The media environments that used to be art forms are subsumed.
Right. Okay, I don't know if you want to go into the next part about a little bit about the Trivium and St. Thomas Aquinas. I don't know if...
Whatever you pick out of it.
No. Let's go.
Why don't you want to do that? Where is that?
Right there. Right below.
Okay, let me just read it and see where we go. This aphorism...
Well, we're going to be reading the whole book, you know that.
Yeah, but let me read this. This aphorism about man at play and at work he specializes is in fact a synthesis of a complex philosophy of education which McLuhan derived from a study of the Trivium and from St. Thomas Aquinas. According to St. Thomas... In fact, intuition, that is the simplex apprehensio, the first pure original even irrational perception of a new idea, comes better to minds clear from two specialist a priori bases. Only afterwards can man start to reflect on this intuition through thought and reasoning, and thus move to the reflexio ad phantasmata phase, literally turning back to sense, literally turning back to sense images. What?
Literally turning back to sense images.
Yeah. The final judizio, or the final conception, statement, or truth, is in fact shaped through this careful process of probing and testing the first intuition by means of fantasy, or fantasies expressed through words. A playful attitude facilitates our intuition, stimulating pattern recognition and helping us to open up our doors of perception. It also helps us to approach knowledge with an inclusive rather than exclusive attitude. So that's really important.
Well, what was interesting about that whole thing is that the way, I guess, grammarians, they define the process, well, the process of cognition, what you cog when you first have a thought and what your senses tell you and how you overlay it. And
with concept. It's always talking about percept and then overlaid by concept.
Right. Yeah.
So, the playfulness of your senses, she's saying, comes from St. Thomas in some way and includes intuition, which is part of percept.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't seem to say much more about that.
I know. It just sort of, that's why I wondered.
Well, she's just explaining the play factor and that there is a historical conceptual background to it. Coming out of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so then the next page, on to 36, just a comment here. It took centuries to move from orality to literacy, but less than a century to shift into the secondary orality of instantaneous information. So that she's just talking about the speed up of the environment of knowledge, of interaction.
Well, what's important, and as McLuhan says, it takes a long time to make a literate population, a couple hundred years for the West.
Mm-hmm.
And when you bring in electric media, the undeveloped, non-literate world immediately adapts or responds to something intensifying their oral tactile bias they already have. And that can create paranoia, but they don't have an opportunity to fall back and retreat and start building a literate anti-environment to the electric media, mm-hmm. because the Western world is going electric too and is dropping the Gutenberg bias.
Right.
So the third world is sort of left frustrated that they can't go left hemisphere. It's evaporating a ground for it. But, okay, so are they going to just be drones in the electric businesses? And so that's what happened.
Well, then you have all the Asians going heavy into their left brain and
trying to
going into all the professions.
And they didn't. They're not that successful at it. Maybe we'll see. Whereas the Westerners are not very successful in adopting right hemisphere modes.
Right.
The going west or going east from opposite cultures is an identity crisis inside the extreme tactile,
right.
secondary tactility.
Yes.
And which threatens everybody. So McLuhan said, okay, you the capitalist, first world, industrial, left hemisphere, property-based environments, they go to the third world and adopt electric means, new advanced environments to make their factories better, but they end up with slave labor and all that stuff that Naomi Klein complains about,
mm-hmm.
you know, disaster capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan's saying, no, we don't need to do that kind of processing of the third world. If we understand our media environments, we can get to almost a post-industrial scenario. But he said the frustration for Africa was, they'd get radio, and then they'd say, but where are the cornflakes? They had no cornflakes. They'd be starving, even though they had whatever electric media was around.
Right.
So it really creates a paralyzed situation for global management where you can't solve the third world's problems in any new ecological use of factory labor. They just dump your old industrial system into the third world, and they all become, frustrated workers.
Right, and I wonder what's going to happen now with Trump bringing business back to America. That means it's the third world loses their factories.
Well, they go to China. China moves into that vacuum as America became a third world country, and therefore it's got cheap labor now. So all the companies come back here and forget about the cheap labor in the third world. You got it back here at home. And then China comes in with all their wealth and buys up all the third world countries.
Well, okay.
So that's the Chinese going west. They take over the European empire or the American empire.
Mm-hmm.
They replace it. And we go third world.
So Britain, what was it? The sun never shines on Britain?
Never sets.
Never.
Now it never shines on it.
So China's the next world conqueror.
Yeah. On the bureaucratic level, because where is the conquering happening? That's only in the chemical body. It's not happening in the digital body.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're really mad at Facebook and think that it's invaded your life and ruined you, then you can have a grievance. But
only 10% of people have dropped off so far.
Okay, so
I guess that's a lot.
But you've got most of the people are signing up to the chip body. They can't stop.
Yeah. Okay, she's quoting McLuhan there then. Centuries from orality to literacy, less than a century to secondary orality of instantaneous information. And then I went to the quote below. The artist is the man in any field, scientific or humanistic, who grasps the implications of his actions and of new knowledge in his own time. He's the man of integral awareness. So there's your integral business.
Yeah.
And that's just to sum up. That's a summation.
Well, the important thing is he's taking the artist out of the categories of humanism and saying the artist can be anybody in science, technology, garbage truck worker, anybody. It can now be, here comes everybody for the artistic sovereignty, artistic supreme awareness, idealizes that, who grasps the implications of his actions and of new knowledge in his own time. I think McLuhan thought that he was the only one doing that.
At the time.
He's the only one who saw the implications of the new media effects, the new media knowledge.
Right. Okay, so then the next paragraph, kind of in the middle, she goes into the integral, defines it. Integral, that is, unifying forma and substantia, form and substance, ground and figure, so there's the figure ground, at once connecting all things and being all things, but also at a deeper level, integral means untouched, pure, entire, intact, as to suggest an unbiased, childlike attitude of approaching knowledge, displaying both curiosity and playfulness. And then awareness, because in the previous quote, it was, he's the man of integral or integral awareness.
Right.
Awareness, that is the alert condition which should be shared by anyone engaged in any form of investigation. Finally, the artist image, itself the symbol of a new forma mentis, based also on the use of imagination as a passe partout.
Partout.
What's a partout?
I don't know. It's a French phrase. I looked it up, but I don't remember it.
Let me see if I can get it.
So forma mentis is just a mental attitude.
Yeah. Continue the quote. I'll look up passe partout.
Finally, the artist image, itself the symbol of a new forma mentis, based also on the use of imagination as a passepartout attitude, opening all doors leading to the discovery of the new environmental dynamics.
It's a picture.
Passepartout is just a picture, okay. The use of imagination is a picture, a posture, attitude, opening all doors. Okay, so it's a picture that allows something to enter, to go, like
well,
a doorway.
A French term for a mat, a paper, or more usually cardboard sheet with a cutout, which is placed under the glass in a picture frame.
So the use of imagination.
So it's like a door frame, a picture frame.
So the imagination is used as a door frame.
Yeah.
Mm.
A frame. It's you put into the frame the picture you want. You create your own picture.
Right.
Based on the use of imagination as a passepartout. So you use your own imagination in your frame.
Mm.
No? You don't get it?
No, I get it.
Okay. Based also on the use of imagination as a passepartout attitude, opening all doors leading to the discovery of the new environmental dynamics.
Yeah, maybe emphasizing a visual framework too much.
Ah, right. The artist image, okay. And then there's a quote from a biologist who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1960. He wrote, imagination is the energizing force of science as well as of poetry. To adopt a conciliatory attitude, let us say that science is the form of poetry, going back now to its classical and more general sense, in which reason and imagination act together synergistically. This simple formal property represents the most important methodological discovery of modern thought. Okay, I have to read that again. What did you get from that, Bob?
I'll do it. Imagination is the energizing force of science as well as of poetry. To adopt a conciliatory attitude, let us say that science is that form of poetry in which reason and imagination act together synergistically. And that's a classical and more general definition. This simple formal property, energizing force of science and poetry, represents the most important methodological discovery of modern thought. Well, since Gutenberg science and Gutenberg art are obsolete, or Gutenberg poetry, they can merge. They both can adopt the idea that they're imagination. Whereas scientists never, I don't think they regard themselves as particularly imaginative. Maybe they're imaginative in what they notice and what they observe and then try to replicate in an experiment. But I see this as the collapse of hard science into a tactile, interdisciplinary merger of categories and classifications that come from Gutenberg. And no longer are the new science. The new science is McLuhan's media ecology. These guys aren't anti-environmental anymore.
Mm-hmm. So he's talking in 1960 about reason and imagination acting together in science. And I wonder what's the example of that happening.
It would be more in the maybe the theories, the theory of everything. You don't see that in the labs.
Mm-hmm.
The labs actually become more and more corrupt,
mm-hmm.
commercialized, especially in medicine.
Yeah, the only thing they're imagining is how to get more grant money.
Right, and or a corporate sponsorship. So you, in your expertise, see the disservices of this situation in medicine,
mm-hmm.
and big pharma. So this is a biologist, Sir Peter Medawar. He says it's an important methodological discovery. No, it's a puny discovery compared to McLuhan's discovery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then they say here, Sir Medawar himself retrieves the idea of a common ground between the sciences and the humanities. They both come from literacy. Based on the fact that reason and imagination forge both poetical perception and scientific observation, it is in the process of identifying and rendering that the two fields seem to diverge. We all tell stories, continues Sir Medawar, but the stories differ in the purposes we expect them to fulfill and in the kinds of evaluations to which they are exposed. So these are leaden, plodding guys, still under the Gutenberg effect, and they don't get to see the dynamic processual information consumption that's going on around them. They use too many literate categories.
So they think they're doing a dialectic, they're marrying, what is it?
Science and poetry.
Reason and imagination.
Yeah.
Science and poetry, but like you keep saying, they're both just literate
right.
functions. So it's just two sides of, what, one side of the same coin?
Yeah, and literacy, when it was an environment and unconscious, then science could stand off with a hard point of view against the softy poets.
Mm-hmm.
That melts under, the polarity melts under electric conditions. And so you end up with books like The Tao of Physics, The Dancing Wooly Masters, both written in Sarfatti's scene, Jack Sarfatti in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
He's the real avant-garde physicist, the post-quantum physicist. What else to say?
So the rest of the...
You know what imagination? Okay, so imagination, as McLuhan used it, is making.
Okay.
As opposed to matching.
All
so
right.
Reason is matching, imagination is making. So both parts of the perceptual process are the content of the new electric tactility or secondary tactility. And Medawar doesn't know these terms, but the comprehensive tetrad manager from his tactile position knows how to shape all dialectics.
So that's what she jumps to over the next page in Laws of Media. So the rest of this paragraph, she's trying to fit the words into storytelling, but it doesn't really relate to McLuhan, and I don't think. So then the next paragraph to look at is... The Electric Grammarian, McLuhan, The Electric Grammarian.
Okay, that's...
This is an idea, Marshall McLuhan, The Electric Grammarian.
Wait a minute, I got to find it. It's in another, we're into the next chapter.
Not at all. It's just one, two, three little paragraphs after Sir Medawar.
That's weird, I don't have it in my book. Oh, I thought it was a title. Yes, I have it as a... Within a sentence.
Yeah.
I think I had something else to say.
This is an idea, Marshall McLuhan, The Electric...
Okay, before you get into that,
right.
After Medawar lays out the hopefulness that something will merge or something will come out of this collapse of visual space and its
mm-hmm.
hardware, she then says, as previously noted, I.A. Richards spoke of, quote, scientific truth or statement and poetical truth or pseudo-statement, asserting that the former needs to be proved while the latter is accepted for what it is. So the truth of oral wisdom is not proved, but it's sort of understood as is by its own evidence, or it just makes sense to people. It has a nice flow.
Mm-hmm.
So there's speech wisdom, and then there is scientific or visually biased wisdom.
Mm.
And Barry Nevitt used to quote, somebody said, the opposite of one great truth is another great truth. So there are opposites when you're not dealing with visual space and the rigid categories of the print world.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
the world of scientific truth. And that tends to be matching. You know, nothing's real until the other parts of the experiment match up with the initial effect.
Yeah, yes, no reality.
So then you have the making, the poetic world of being a good conversationalist or an interesting conversationalist and maybe write interesting short poems. Those two aspects start hanging out together, the scientist and the poet, which is what Medawar noticed. But I.A. Richards predicted it way back there. If you look up, what's the date of that? Is that number footnote 7?
I've obscured it with my highlighting.
Right. So I don't know how it could be number 7.
Yeah, the one before is 67.
So what am I looking at?
That must be 68.
Doesn't have any number. But she'd already done it before. So anyways, it's written in the 30s or 40s, you know, way back there. By scan back, Richard, Science and Poetry, 58. Richard's. Richard's. That's 1970, unless that's a reprint. So you could say maybe after the 60s, after the Global Theater, science and poetry were melted. Because in the 50s, you had the strict image of the scientist in a lab coat and then the beatnik poet. They certainly weren't hanging out in the same area. So this may be a new pattern as it caused by the Global Theater. The visual space collapsed into its, a big parody of all its specialisms. So then she says, so statement seems to be, yet statement seems to implicitly suggest that there is a deeper and fundamental level in which reason and imagination, sciences and humanities, scientific truth and poetical truth meet. This deeper level is language, or even better, storytelling. As Sir Medawar reminds us, we all tell stories. Now, that's what, in the 70s, William Rowan Thompson does. He calls it myth versus science, and in the end, he says they're all mythical in the sense of storytellers. So McLuhan talked about, in the 60s, C.P. Snow talking about the two cultures, science and humanities, never talking to each other. But there's going to be a merger between them in the 60s, or start to acknowledge each other, because they're both obsolete. They're looking for allies to have an informational elite, all right, justify university education. Meanwhile, McLuhan is talking on a third level, saying the real science is noticing how the Global Theater makes the rigid categories of science and poetry change. Okay, so Electric Grammarian. You want to read that?
Well, yeah. This is an idea of Marshall McLuhan.
I think you have to read the quote first.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so when you ended with "We all tell stories," the next paragraph, words are the most unique man-made artifacts, and language and the stories we tell act as the unifying agent. And then there's a quote, you can look up where it's from. Words are complex systems of metaphors and symbols that translate experience into our uttered or outered senses. They are a technology of explicitness. By means of translation of immediate sense experience into vocal symbols, the entire world can be evoked and retrieved at any instant.
And that's a quote from Understanding Media, page 85. So that's right. McLuhan saying that.
So McLuhan said that, and then Lamberti goes on. This is an idea, Marshall McLuhan, dash, the electric grammarian, comma, a modern Janus, dash, took from the ancient doctrine of Logos, also known as the doctrine of names, the founding language for both physics and metaphysics. Together with his son Eric, he extended this doctrine into a new science, which subsequently resulted in their laws of media, based on an applied probing model called the tetrad. The tetrad is deeply rooted in the Logos. And what's Janus, a modern Janus?
That's a double-faced, triple-faced Greek god.
Yeah, okay. Roman mythology. It's Roman, Bob.
Okay.
Roman
Did
mythology.
I say Greek?
Yeah. An ancient Italian deity, guardian of doorways and gates, and protector of the state of time of war. He's usually represented with two faces so that he looks both forward and backward. Isn't that interesting? So, McLuhan is a modern day looking backward and forward. That's cool.
Yeah, like he explained the future by quoting the past.
And then Lambert is talking about science and poetics matching, and McLuhan comes up with his own science. So that's cool that McLuhan thought he had to, even though he was marrying science and poetics, he still thought he had to have his own science.
Yes, he wanted to explain the ground. The marrying of science and poetics is a desperate reunion by divorced people who are now coming back together for some stressful reason. Maybe they lost their jobs and no one else likes them, so they get back with their former wife or husband, and they get jobs, work part-time, and they survive because the digital environment went around them and evaporated all income into the Wall Street panic ecstasy waltz. All right, so and so
you're just telling the story.
I'm not making a story. And so McLuhan comes in, you know, the Wizard of Oz, and says, no, we can turn off the Wall Street virtual reality and have people stop faking their remarriage. So that's what, but you see, the new science is looking at deeper causes. Science is supposed to understand causes and effects. Mm-hmm. And if you're studying the biological cause and effects, that's a limited situation. That's been obsolesced by the satellite. If you start analyzing body chemistries like medicine, you end up with very bad, dangerous drugs. Mm-hmm. And they're only why did medicine convert to drugs? Because the electric speed up of the economy gave nobody time to be a regular old-fashioned doctor anymore. So they had to come up with a product to give people and see people, 20 people an hour or more, and so that you can get your income because your rent's going up because of inflation caused by the computerized economy. That's the story.
Yeah.
Okay, so you see where he's coming in on another level of causes and effects.
Mm-hmm.
But because he can't prove it in the old scientific matching way, he can't prove what he's pointing out, regular old-fashioned big pharma science rejects McLuhan. But on the poetic level, it makes sense to a lot of people what he's saying. There's the immediate sense of the pattern of, well, obviously television is doing something to us because it's an experience, a new experience, and how do you measure it? Where do you go to do a laboratory type? So we'll just go with what the artists and storytellers who are changing their stories and their art, why they're changing. To give us clues to the new sensory dynamics.
And that's what she says in the very last paragraph. It's a long paragraph, so it's...
Before you do that, I just want to review what you just read. This is an idea Marsh McLuhan, the electric grammarian, a modern Janus, took from the ancient doctrine of the Logos, also known as the doctrine of names, the founding language for both physics and metaphysics. So he's going back to the ground in literacy, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
They extended this doctrine, Eric and Marshall, into a new science which subsequently resulted in the laws of media based on an applied probing model called the tetrad. And then the tetrad is deeply rooted in the Logos. The ancient whole is recomposed, and the two halves, speech and reason, are once more combined and allowed to regain their primordial nosiological function. Nosiological is an actual word, Carolyn.
I know. Let's see what... They won't tell me what it means. Oh, maybe they will. No dictionary results. It doesn't exist, Bob.
G-N-O-S. I looked it up. In my computer, it showed up when I read it.
Okay.
The tetrad is deeply rooted in the Logos. That's like, if the Logos is a medium, it's saying the tetrad is kind of redundant. It's kind of a Hendiades here.
Well, the tetrad is about words. It's not about chemical formulas or anything like that. So,
but
it is.
The Logos
in word.
I don't think the Logos is limited to words.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
If it's speech and reason, there's a mind element in there.
Logos. the word of God or principle of divine reason and creative order.
You ever heard that?
Yeah.
You never heard that?
We've looked up Logos.
No, you've never heard the meaning of definition. The word of God. You ever heard the word of God? What language does he speak in?
Angel.
Does she speak in?
Angel.
Angel language, right. So it's not limited to words.
Gotcha.
But human words.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I'm not sure about her elaboration here. I think there's a deeper... the Logos is an extension. There's the spherical Logos before the phonetic alphabet, but that is a product of the technology of speech. Then it gets literalized and becomes the three parts, the trivium, break up the Logos. You know, the sphere breaks up into pyramidal fragments. I'm not sure, but there's the evolution of the Logos via media is the more important statement, not that the tetrad comes from it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Though she might have a definition of Logos that includes what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you want to read the whole final paragraph?
Not really. I think the summation is toward the middle of that paragraph.
Okay.
And... just like the metaphor, the tetrad provides a tool to approach and perceive the essence of our new man-made environment. It works like an all-embracing, unifying verbal equation for reading and revealing landscape. That is, our planet perceived and rendered as an art form. Language is turned into the cognitive medium, the arche to which everything returns. What's arche?
I don't know. I can't even find what you're reading, but it's the last paragraph, right?
Yeah, but it's just a third way down.
Okay, I'm going to read just like the metaphor. Is that the beginning?
Yeah.
The tetrad provides the tool to approach and perceive the essence of our new man-made environment. It works like an all-embracing, unifying verbal equation for reading and revealing landscape. That is, our planet perceived and rendered as an art form. Language is turned into the cognitive medium, the arche to which everything returns. Oh, you said arche?
Yeah.
It's archetype.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the archetype. But something off here. The tetrad, remember McLuhan said he wrote cartoons. The tetrad's a cartoon. It works like an all-embracing unifying verbal equation for reading and revealing landscape that is our planet perceived and rendered as an art form. Language is turned into the cognitive medium, the arche to which everything returns. If you say everything is words, so everything returns to words, why? So she's saying the tetrad is a bunch of words. Okay.
Okay, so maybe what you're perceiving is that she doesn't truly understand the tetrad?
No, I think it's correct what she says, that it returns to language, because the tetrad is a collection of words. It's not a TV station. It's not a spaceship. It's just a little word pattern. And she's saying that's the original medium. Perceived and rendered as an art form, language is turned into the cognitive medium, the archetype to which everything returns. Well, that's a hope. Nothing returns. And now here we are 30 years later, and have we returned to anything? No, we go rushing headlong into post-cyborg mania. You know, so the tetrad gives you a reason, looking for a reason, gives you a pattern. But I don't think pattern recognition is enough. And McLuhan said the laser beam will just fry our brains and will be wiped off the